20 days, one historic move, an unbelievable journey. Melania from the Amazon MGM Studios captures the one-of-a-kind transition into the White House, showcasing the planning, the pressure, and personal moments that come with stepping into the role of the First Lady for a second time. From logistical complexities to decisions made behind closed doors, the film brings you closer to Mrs. Trump and her family as they return to the nation's capital. See what history looks like before the doors officially open. Melania arrives exclusively in theaters January 30th, 2026.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
I'm from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, which is going to be buried in snow. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Probably everybody listening to me right now, almost everybody, outside a huge listening audience in Florida, is going to get hit by snow. I mean, you're talking about Texas, you're talking about North Carolina, all the way up the coast through Virginia. Mark Thiessen standing by. We have Shervin Pishore, an Iranian American entrepreneur, talk about what's happening as we send, in the president's words, an armada to Iran. We don't know if we're going to use it or not. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Do you think we are close to the final 10% of this deal? Do you think this will get done the next few weeks?
The final 10%, I don't know about the next few weeks, but I know we've made more progress, according to the Ukrainians, more progress than in the last 3 or 4 years.
Really? I'm more concerned about the Russians. Maybe Steve Witkoff should focus on the Russians, but he was in Moscow. Let's hope he's right. Trouble spots, front and center, Ukraine and Iran. How both will be confronted within 2 weeks, I'll explain.
Number two.
Do a lot of campaign traveling. Now, we're going to work hard. Whatever reason, it's a deep down psychological reason. Sitting presidents don't seem to do well in the midterms.
It's not a psychological reason. I don't think anyone's really figured it out, except for the American people want balance, I guess. But the president's always been unorthodox and does things differently. And maybe it'll result in success here. 11 months to the midterms, and the president will have a laser eye on the economy. While polls are down and the economic figures are sky high, from the GDP to the stock market, and the numbers are unbelievably low when it comes to crime. How Trump could possibly bridge the disconnect and buck history.
Number one.
There's some hope, some reason to think that there's going to be better cooperation in the weeks and months to come. These people are going to step up and actually ask the cops to protect our ICE officers when they're being assaulted.
I would think so, but I don't. But I doubt it. J.D. Vance going over to Minneapolis to try to calm people down. ICE is not going anywhere, people. And Minneapolis better get used to it. The temperature's got to come down. I thought the VP did a good job yesterday. He's doing this. This is, we learned that crime in America is at a 100-year low in certain categories and has a lot to do with ICE's success and 2 million people self-deporting, a lot of which are illegal immigrant criminals because they know the president's coming for them. Mark Thiessen joins us now. Washington Post columnist, Fox News contributor, AEI fellow. Great to see you. Great to hear from you, Mark.
Great to be with you, Brian.
First off, let's begin with what you hear from Russia. Jared Kushner and Steve Witkoff, along with one of the newest members of the brand new Board of Peace, go and visit Vladimir Putin. And one thing they released that was kind of interesting, they say Vladimir Putin sincerely is pushing for this peace effort. Do you believe it?
No. Vladimir Putin isn't sincere about peace. He doesn't want peace. He wants Ukraine. I mean, we've now gone for a year of trying to convince Vladimir Putin to end this war. The Ukrainians have agreed to pretty much everything we've asked them to do, so starting with, you know, an immediate ceasefire and going through now. They're even, you know, willing to make certain territorial concessions. We've got an agreement that's 90% there in terms of deal. The only thing that's outstanding is really that Putin is not willing to accept the security guarantees for Ukraine. Well, why would you not accept security guarantees for Ukraine if you plan to have a permanent peace? Because you plan to start the war as soon as Donald Trump leaves, and he's not willing to take that, allow those security guarantees in. And you know, they had a deal right between the week between Christmas and New Year. Trump was absolutely convinced that he had a deal with Putin, that he spent time on the phone with Putin, talked to him. Putin was agreeing to everything he said, and he basically, what he did is he cornered Putin, and then Putin came up with this fake story about about how Zelensky attacked one of his residences to blow up the deal.
And
that doesn't tell
totally
you everything you need to know. It's completely fictitious, and Trump knew it was fictitious and was really mad at him, and rightly so. And at this point, it should be obvious that the obstacle to peace is Vladimir Putin, and we need this. We're never going to get him to come around unless we really put the screws on him.
Couple of things. They got this guy, Igor Kostyukov, and Kirill Dmitriev, who I think was the one who was the envoy meeting in Miami. He's going there. And this is the exact quote. Putin underlined that Russia was sincerely interested. I know Jack Keane says the same thing as you. And Steve Witkoff, by the way, said, we're really down to one issue. So I don't know if that was the peacekeeping force. I'm not sure what that was. Or is it the whole Donbas province, which he's not going to get. So I thought I thought about you when I saw some Zelensky speak yesterday. He has had it with Europe, almost like the president has. And here's what he said about NATO. Cut 20.
Europe needs to know how to defend itself. And if you send 30 or 40 soldiers to Greenland, what is that for? What message does it send? What's the message to Putin, to China? And even more importantly, what message does it send to Denmark? The most important, your close ally.
Right. He goes, you keep spending all your time trying to change Donald Trump. Donald Trump is happy who he is. And that's just it. I think he totally gets it.
Yes, 100%. Well, the idea that they sent 40 troops to hold off the United States military in Denmark was an embarrassment. Exactly right. And look, I think Trump has gotten the Europeans to come around on Greenland. We're going to have bases in Greenland. And by the way, everyone who says that like Trump is in Putin's pocket and that he's, and all that loves Putin, wants to give Putin everything he wants. Do you think Vladimir Putin wants a massive U.S. military expansion in Greenland? He doesn't want that because what are we going to do in Greenland? We're going to set up interceptors to shoot down his missiles so he can't threaten us with nuclear Armageddon. We're going to counter his ability to take over the Arctic, which he's been investing massively in. We're going to secure the Northwest Passage and the Arctic sea lanes that he wants to control. We're actually moving into the Arctic in a big way. That's the last thing that Vladimir Putin wants. The last thing Putin wants is for NATO to spend 5% of GDP on defense. All the things that Trump is doing are things that Putin does not want. So, I think NATO needs to like step up and put on their big boy pants and start spending on defense and taking the lead on security in Europe. I mean, Zelensky's right, and so is Trump.
Here is Zelensky after meeting with Trump. Cut 22.
President Trump loves who he is, and he says he loves Europe. But he will not listen to this kind of Europe. One of the biggest problems in today's Europe, though it's not often talked about, is the mindset. Some European leaders are from Europe, but not always for Europe. And Europe still feels more like a geography, history, a tradition, not a real political force, not a great power.
And it's almost like he's saying, look, I'm telling you what Russia's perspective are and the U.S. perspective. You guys are not players. You can scream, you can shout, you can urge, you can act, you can squawk, but no one's paying attention to you, not our enemies or not our allies.
Yeah, and we need them to step up because, as you can see from the we have troops now. We have a massive military deployment in the Caribbean to deal with the Maduro regime and the Venezuelan drug traffickers. We're steaming ships to the Mediterranean to deal with Iran. We've got to deter China in the Pacific. We don't have the resources to spend all of our time and resources focusing on Europe. We have an important interest there. We need to help them, but they have to step up and take the lead for security. It's been the Cold War ended in 1991. World War II ended in 1945. Like, at what point is Europe going to have primary responsibility for its own security? And the sooner they step up, the more willing the American people are going to be to back them up. But they've been hiding behind our skirts for seven decades, and it's time for them to start taking the primary responsibility for security in their own hemisphere. And if they do, then the American people are going to be willing to play an important role. It doesn't mean we're getting out. It's just we need to play the supporting role in securing Europe, not the primary role in securing Europe.
No, I hear it too. And by the way, Latvia says the damage might be permanent between us and the United States and NATO. Really? That's big of Latvia. Do you really think that anyone but the Americans are going to protect Latvia? Serbia said the same thing. Some damage is done because of the threat of going into Greenland. Really? You're actually taking a stand against America. And then I hear the Canadians said we have to, or one of these European countries says we have to have a substitute for the American nuclear umbrella. Good luck. Who's stopping you? Go form your own armed forces. Protect yourself. That'll be a huge relief for us.
Look, everybody said this whole, every time Trump is president, they would start whining about how he's threatening the NATO alliance. So in the first term, you remember that he said, they asked him, are you going to defend NATO allies under Article 5 if they don't pay their 2%? And he said, no. And everybody set their hair on fire. The only European leader with a full head of hair these days is Rutte, because he's not setting his hair on fire every time the NATO
team. Right.
Like that. And what happened? They ended up now after pressure from Trump, they've added hundreds of billions of dollars to their defense budgets. They're all meeting their 2%, and they've agreed to go to 5%. He made NATO stronger by making that threat. Now it's the same thing with Greenland. Instead of engaging on the fundamental problem, which is the Europeans, but not even investing in their own defense, how are they going to invest in securing Greenland? They don't have the money, right. They don't have the resources, they don't have the will, and the United States is the only country who can secure Greenland. And so instead of setting their hair on fire, say, let's sit down with the Trump administration and come up with a common plan to secure Greenland. And, you know, now I think we're finally doing it, but it's only because Trump, because Trump made the threats that he did. So, you know, the NATO alliance is going to be fine. Trump is not the threat to it. The biggest threat to the NATO alliance is the unwillingness of the NATO allies to carry their weight in the alliance.
All right. I want you to hear the president on Iran. Cut 28.
You know, we have a lot of ships going that direction just in case. We have a big flotilla going in that direction. And we'll see what happens. We have a big force going toward Iran. I'd rather not see anything happen, but we're watching them very closely.
What do you think should happen when we get there? And they say, analysts say they worry that if you know, what's next at that regime? Can you really get involved on the ground? What could we hit that would make a difference for the protesters who have been beaten and killed in massive numbers and jailed by the team in terms of maybe 22,000?
Yeah. So here's the thing. Donald Trump understands he has to act in Iran because he drew a red line. He said, if the Iranian regime kills thousands of protesters, they're going to pay a price. We're going to strike them militarily. They killed tens of thousands of protesters. He then said to the Iranian people, rise up and take your institutions. Help is on the way. If he doesn't follow through on those promises, America's credibility is absolutely destroyed on the world stage, and he understands that. And it would be if he does, and the people who are urging him to now sit down and negotiate with the Iranians, what they're doing is basically saying, why don't you be just like Barack Obama? Because what Barack Obama, remember when Barack Obama drew his red line in Syria? He said, if you use chemical weapons, there's going to be a price to pay, and it's going to be military action. And the Syrians said, screw you, and they used chemical weapons 14 times on their people. And he didn't act, and he went and through Russia negotiated a deal for them to disarm of their chemical weapons, which they violated. That is what people are arguing that Trump should do now with Iran. He's not Barack Obama. He's not going to not enforce his red line and then negotiate a fake disarmament deal with the Iranian regime. So he's got one of the things I respect about Donald Trump is he does what he says. He said help is on the way,
right.
And I believe he's going to do it.
What are his options?
His options are to decapitate the regime. I mean, the options are to do what we did with Maduro. except from the air. I mean, take out the Ayatollah, take out the IRGC forces, take out their command and control, take out their missile capability, blow up that damn ICBM they just tested that could reach the United States, and let the Iranian people rise up, and then take their country back. And if the regime doesn't fall and some remnant comes in, then you do what we did, then you start dealing with the Iranian Delcy Rodriguez, and you say and you say okay, here's what you're going to do. And if you don't do it, you'll suffer the same fate as the Ayatollah. And then you whack them. And if the next person who steps up, if they don't do what we tell them, we whack them. And we keep doing it until they capitulate. It's not, the reality is that we, and by the way, everybody who wants to say, I'm so sick of being tied up in the Middle East. We've been there for decades. Why are we in the Middle East? We got other problems in our hemisphere. We got China to deal with. The best way to pivot away from the Middle East is to get rid of the Iranian regime. Then we don't have to be there. Then we don't have to have tens of thousands of troops stationed in the Middle East. Then we don't have to have our aircraft carriers sitting there all the time. This is the solution to all of our problems. We're having trouble getting Hamas to disarm. You take away their patron in Tehran, and they've got nobody. It's going to make everything easier. He's got to deal with this regime.
And you also got to deal. It also helps our situation with China because they're getting discount oil from Iran, and they are providing missile defense. And by the way, according to Bill Gertz in the Washington Times, the DIA has told him that by 2035, they'll have 60 long range missiles, nuclear missiles. That's more than North Korea. So I'm pretty sure that's not going to stand. And this is like the only president we're guaranteed that would take that seriously because we watch too many other people try to negotiate. Mark, thanks so much. A lot going on.
Take care, Brian.
You got it. 1-866-408-7669. We go inside the Iranian question in just a moment. The bottom of the hour with an Iranian-American entrepreneur and technical strategist with deep connections into that country. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
This is Ainsley Earhart. Thank you for joining me for the 52-episode podcast series, The Life of Jesus.
A listening experience that will provide hope, comfort, and understanding of the greatest story ever told. Listen and follow now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you listen to podcasts.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You know, the U.S. is a year into the second Trump administration now, and a lot of people are suffering. And I'm wondering how you're feeling about things back home personally.
I don't like to kind of dabble too much into politics.
I've been asking a lot of the American players just how it feels to play under the American flag right now, and I'm curious how you feel. Sort of in the context of the last year of everything that's been happening in the U.S., does that complicate that feeling at all?
I don't think that's relevant.
There's a lot happening back home in the U.S. and kind of has been for a lot of the last year. And I'm just kind of wondering how you're feeling about all of it.
I don't know. I feel like whatever I say here is going to get put in a headline and it's going to get taken out of context.
Yeah, exactly. And that was just one reporter thought to be from The Atlantic who's just asking these tennis players at the Australian Open, which is like the World Series and Super Bowl for them, you know, can you say something bad against Trump? And I think everybody except Coco Gauff punted on that. And I love what John Isner said. He's a big, tall guy. He said, I'm here to play tennis. That's a totally inappropriate question. Ask me about tennis. That's what you say. Unless you want to do that. But usually people, if they want to make those statements, they make the statements. They don't need a question from the press. I dedicate this match to all the ICE agents, or I dedicate this match to everyone fighting the ICE agents. So, you know, and by the way, if you listen to all the questions, it's there to rip Trump. They're not curious to see if they support Trump. We come back inside the Iranian situation as the protesters pay for them with their lives, for their families to get their bodies back. They have to pay for the bullets used to kill their loved ones. Do you believe that?
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
As for Iran, everyone is waiting to see what America will do. And the world offers nothing, Europe offers nothing, and doesn't know want to enter this issue as a supporter of the Iranian people and the democracy they need. But when you refuse to help the people fighting for freedom, the consequences return, and they are always negative. Belarus in 2020 is the example. No one helped their people, and now Russian Oreshnik missiles are deployed in Belarus within range of most European capitals. That would not have happened if the Belarusian people had won in 2020.
It's such a good point. And Zelensky was on fire yesterday, and he's accurate. He was not only just talking about Ukraine. He was saying, look at how you look to the aggressors in this world, whether it's China or Russia. And Belarus overthrew Lukashenko. He lost the election. Lukashenko calls Putin. Putin helps him suppress the rebellion. And now he becomes a vassal state of Russia, and they use this as a staging area in Ukraine. It's all related. Now, he calls him out and says, what are you going to do in Iran? What are you going to do? You're depending on the U.S., who you keep criticizing to do stuff. And guess what we're doing? It looks like we're prepared to take action. I'm not sure, but we're having armada, in the president's words, an armada is steaming their direction. We'll be in the Persian Gulf, if it's not there now, shortly. Shervan Peshevar is with us now. He's an Iranian-American entrepreneur, technology strategist, and democracy advocate focused on advancing uncensorable internet, which has been shut down in Iran, and satellite connectivity in authoritarian environments, which really is the definition of what Iran is now. Shervan, right now, wasn't Zelensky right in what he was saying?
Thank you, Brian, for having me on the show. This is a historic moment, and this topic is so important for the future of our world. Absolutely, he's right. We have to fight back against what I call these corrupt criminal gangs that have taken over sovereign nations with nuclear bombs or seeking nuclear bombs, funding terrorist proxies all over the world, exporting their terrorist ideologies, Islamo-socialist ideologies into Europe. Europe has fallen. America has a mayor in New York City, our biggest city, that is part of that same alliance. We have to wake up. The world has been asleep. Millions of Iranians came out on the streets, defenseless, courageous, one of the greatest acts of courage that anyone has ever seen. And then they were slaughtered just a week ago in 48 hours. The numbers are now reaching 20,000 dead. That's over 10 murders a second at 16,000 dead. So you can do the math as the numbers keep increasing. They're going into hospitals and killing defenseless people in the hospitals. This is medieval, evil ideology that has taken over Iran in the revolution in 1979. What a huge mistake Carter made, the beginning of the woke kind of socialist, democratic alliances that began to happen, thinking that bringing an Ayatollah like Khomeini into power of one of the richest oil countries in the world was a good idea. Look what's happened. We've had 47 years of the Iranian people living under slavery, living in essentially an open-air prison, and now an extermination camp. And if we don't stop them, if we don't support leaders like Reza Pahlavi, the crown prince, who wants to bring in democracy to Iran, Iran was allied with America and Israel before 1979. We had a huge ally. We lost that. And look at the repercussions for us in the world. And this can be corrected. Thank God that in this moment in history, we have President Trump, we have Prime Minister Netanyahu, we have Crown Prince Reza Pahlavi. These three leaders are playing a historic role. It wouldn't be possible without their moral courage. And they told people to come out, and there's a moral duty to do something. They said, we have your backs, we're armed and loaded. And guess what? The armada, as you said, is right there, willing and able to do something about it and end this this evil regime.
So we see the USS Abraham Lincoln is making sway that direction right through the South China Sea. It was there, and now it's been spotted right in the region. The George H.W. Bush is also at sea in the Atlantic, bound for the region and departing from Virginia's naval station over in Norfolk. So that is some serious firepower. But what's interesting, Shervin, from the military perspective, I've never seen Prime Minister Netanyahu publicly say, ask America to hold off. I don't think they were ready. Missile defense-wise, they also, I think, need us if they're going to get hit with a series of ballistic missiles. I think they need us there to help knock those rockets out of the sky. So what do you think? And I know other nations who are rivals of Iran in the region asked us to hold off. Why do you think that is?
Look, the 12-day war was extremely successful. The target was to get rid of the nuclear capability, and they did. I wish they had finished the job. I keep saying finish the job, and finish the job means get rid of the supreme leader and all of the generals and leaders of this evil regime, and let the people finish the job after that. The crown prince is ready to go back to the country. The reason I think the hesitation is there, people are, it's normal. People are afraid of repercussions and what
they don't know what's next,
et cetera.
They don't know what's next.
They don't know what's next. But we know what's next. The Iranian people have already come in the streets by the millions. They've given up their lives for freedom. They are the vast, vast majority of the country. This is a country of 92 million people. This is not Afghanistan. This is not Iraq. This is not going to be a failed state. The oil revenues are going to go into accounts just like in Venezuela that are going to be legalized by the president's executive order that they did in on Venezuela. And then that can fund the interim government and can fund the operations of the country and the reconstruction of the country and until there's a referendum and a vote on what kind of democracy they want. There's a process to be had. There's an interim government to be formed. And luckily, we have the crown prince, Reza Pahlavi, stepping up.
Here, Sherman, I got to stop you there because the president says he's a nice man, but he does not have popular support for the type of thing where he could take power. What is your take on what he, what the president believes and has been told about his popularity in the country?
I think if you just have to take a look at the videos, there's millions of people in the streets. He called out for them to come out at 8 p.m. They did. Javed Shah means long live the Shah. His name is on the lips of these people that went out. There's many, many videos where they're saying this might be my last video. And they went out in the streets and they said Reza Shah's name to come back and leave the country. The proof is in the videos.
So which did you hit, Sherman? I know you're not a military analyst, but where are the places that you would target if you were the U.S. and you wanted to take out this evil regime? What do you do?
The capabilities of this regime. This is not asking for carpet bombing. No one would ask for that. We're asking for very precise hits on the leadership, either arresting Khamenei like they did Maduro, or hitting them where it hurts, and also hitting the military capabilities that they're using, the military depots, the weapons depots that they're using to massacre people in the streets with weapons grade guns. So.
Yeah. So I want you to hear this. Congressman Jason Crow, a Democrat and Army Ranger, said this about the president. Obviously, he's got some critics. Cut 31.
Iran is another good example. Iran is a rogue, violent terrorist regime, to be very clear. But is the answer to that to go to war with Iran? I firmly believe no. But more than anything, if that's what they think is in the interest of this country, then it damn well should be debated and voted on in the building behind me. That's the point.
So you understand American politics. So he's going to have, he had critics in Venezuela and it was a brilliant operation. What about this?
Look, I think the bigger issue here is that we are in the critical hours. What's decided in the next, few days or weeks will really determine the next decades ahead, not just for Iranians and Iran, but for the whole world. We cannot have a country with the oil reserves and energy reserves that, like Iran, have the ability to finance terrorism around the world and export hate. We saw what happened in the Middle East for 47 years when they did that. We see what they're doing in invading Europe and America with their ideologies and their agents. We are already at war, and it's time to finish it.
So the IRGC, and I guess we'll see. Do you think that Israel has to help us with this?
Oh, absolutely. I think Prime Minister Netanyahu is very committed to ending this regime and helping free the Iranians. And if you've studied the Bible, Cyrus the Great, 2,500 years ago, the great Persian leader who declared the first Declaration of Human Rights, he freed the Jews from slavery in Babylon 2,500 years ago, returned them to their homeland in Jerusalem, rebuilt their temple, and in biblical symmetry, 2,500 years later, it's Israel and the Jews that are helping free the Iranians from their slavery.
Lastly, do you worry about sleeper cells here being enacted? I mean, they're already trying multiple times to assassinate Trump.
Absolutely. They've already tried. Their agents are in the U.S. and all over Europe. There's a reason why the background here is out of focus in terms of location. I'm already on the most wanted list of the Islamic regime for being such a vocal advocate for the freedom of the Iranian people. It's time to expel all of the Islamic regime's ambassadors, diplomatic staff in all over the world. In Europe, they work out of the Pakistani embassy in Washington, D.C., and they recruit agents. They need to be expelled.
Shervin, then do you have any reason to believe the president's looking to take action?
I think that the president, having known him, I've had dinner with him, spoken to him about Iran. I think he's a man of his word. That's one thing I've learned about him. When he says what he said to the Iranian people, that if anything happens to them, he will take action. He has their back. They're armed and loaded. I believe him. I think we've all learned to believe President Trump when he makes a promise.
Yeah, Soleimani, al-Baghdadi, Maduro, Syria. Yeah, you take our guys, we're going to take a lot of your guys. And I think that's pretty clear. And then the Iranian operation to blow up their nukes. He tried 5 rounds of talks. There wasn't a 6th. Shervin, thanks so much. Thanks for what you do.
Thank you.
Our audience appreciates the insight. Rather than ranting, you have insight, so we appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, sir.
Shervin Pishyavar, the Iranian-American entrepreneur. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. News, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
This time it was highly consequential. On two sides, it was obviously the speech by the Canadian Prime Minister and then Trump going there and rebuking Europe over and over and over and over and over again. But what's interesting is off stage, and if you weren't a world leader, I'd say 98% of all conversations were about the application of AI and how radically the world is about to change. And yet coverage of it was almost wholly focused on Trump, which is kind of a metaphor and a microcosm of our existence today. Everyone's talking about Greenland when the outcome in Greenland was essentially what we had a week ago. We had all this drama in between.
Yeah. And so the one thing about Trump, you don't have to convince him on AI. I mean, he has an AI czar. They talk about it all the time. He meets with NVIDIA and all. NVIDIA probably meets the CEO there with Trump more than anything else. And sadly, he's agreed to sell chips to China. And Alibaba and company, these companies in China are getting prepared to take NVIDIA chips. Why we do that? The theory was, well, if you sell them to China, they're not going to innovate their own. And if they innovate their own, they'll never need us. So what? Let them innovate their own. The only way they'll be able to innovate their own is if they steal it and reverse engineer it. That's what's had said in the past. So more from AI. Jensen Henson and Larry Fink, BlackRock, Cut 52.
So you actually believe we're going to face labor shortages. So how do you see that AI and robotics changing the nature of work rather than eliminating it?
Yeah, there's several different ways that we could think through it. First of all, this is the largest infrastructure build out in human history. That's going to create a lot of jobs. And it's wonderful that the jobs are related to tradecraft. And we're going to have plumbers and electricians and construction and steel workers and network technicians and people who install and fit out the equipment. And all of these jobs, in the United States, we're seeing quite a significant boom in this area. Salaries have gone up nearly doubled.
Yeah.
And so we're talking about six-figure salaries for people who are building chip factories or computer factories or AI factories. And we have a great shortage in that. And I'm really delighted to see so many people in so many countries really recognizing this important area.
Yeah, but that is Larry Fink and Jensen Huang of NVIDIA, too. They're weighing in on what's going to happen. Also, the data centers. So you need pipe fitters, you need plumbers, you need electricians. So these are the types of skills people need. What you don't need anymore is coding, because you can have AI actually do that. In terms of us moving way into the future, talk about artificial intelligence, it's still back to the future when it's the trades that people are beginning to wake up to understand there's great opportunities there. It's not a fallback. Here's Mike Rowe reacting to the AI buzz at Davos. Cut 53.
The question is, what are we going to do about it? Here's an idea. This year, my foundation got 10 times the applications for trade school scholarships than we got last year. 10 times. People are getting the memo. They're just not quite sure what to do about it. I think we ought to convene, maybe not in Switzerland, maybe somewhere stateside, and talk about rethinking the way we train the next generation for these jobs. But we are in violent agreement on this. It's a massive undertaking. We're going to need hundreds of thousands of skilled workers that we currently don't have. The stakes seem awfully high. And for what it's worth, gentlemen, I'm at your disposal if I can be of use.
So, you know, of course, Mike Rowe's got his foundation, Mike Rowe Works, and he's got those scholarships too, and you got those jobs, and now seem more attractive. It's got to come from parents to have an 11th grader that's okay in school but doesn't love it. Really good with their hands. You can pick that up in 2 seconds. You have to put some furniture together. You know, if your kid can figure it out. I don't have that gene. People in my family do have that gene. My dad had it. You could put together anything, an engine overnight. I wouldn't even know where to start. I mean, even with directions, I'm glued to every single step, including laying out everything ahead of time. Where people who are good at it don't even need directions, they throw them out. So those people got to go ahead. You're not sacrificing the quality of life. You're not just waiting to retire to get your great benefits. You're starting in maybe six figures, and welders and pipe fitters and things of that nature. So and the question is, once the data center's built and the power stations are done, what are you going to do? I think there's always going to be power to be built. I think there's always going to be a need. And if you are a plumber, I'm telling you right now, while you wait for the major contract from Meta, you could actually be extremely successful in your neighborhood. All right, this is Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't forget, I'm going to be in Fort Myers, Florida. I'm going to be there on February 14th. Go to BrianKilmeade.com. I can see you in person. And then on May 30th in beautiful Reno, Nevada, History, Liberty, and Laughs on stage. It's time to feel patriotic again. Don't move.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
All right, from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, around the country, around the world, we're back in action, ready to go, closing out a wild week, looking straight ahead at a monster storm that's going to, I think, affect 50% of the country. So we, this hour, are going to be joined by Darryl Johnson. You know him, three-time Super Bowl champ, former Dallas Cowboys fullback and NFL game analyst with Fox Sports, does a fantastic job. He's going to break down the two games this weekend, which a lot of us were going to watch anyway, but now we're going to be snowed in, and we're going to be taking in the Patriots and Broncos. Now, the Broncos come in with a backup quarterback who hasn't started a game in 2 years. Rams against the Seahawks. This will be the third time these two played. Trey Gowdy's joining us at the bottom of the hour. Congressman Jason Smith is standing by, one of the most impactful congressmen and powerful congressmen in Washington. He's chairman of House Ways and Means. I'll be with him in a second talking about the issue that matters most to you, and that's the economy. And it's going to matter the most for this November's midterm election. So let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Do you think we are close to the final 10% of this deal? Do you think this will get done in the next few weeks?
The final 10%, I don't know about the next few weeks, but I know we've made more progress, according to the Ukrainians, more progress than in the last 3 or 4 years.
Trouble spots front and center. You got Ukraine, you got Iran, how both will be confronted, and I think solved or resolved one way or another in the next 2 weeks.
Number two.
Do a lot of campaign traveling. Now, we're going to work hard. whatever reason, it's a deep down psychological reason, sitting presidents don't seem to do well in the midterms.
Well, let's see if he can buck those odds. 11 months of the midterms, we'll see how it goes.
Number one.
There's some hope, some reason to think that there's going to be better cooperation in the weeks and months to come. These people are going to step up and actually ask the cops to protect our ICE officers when they're being assaulted.
The VP tries to settle things down and make cooler heads prevail in Minneapolis. I doubt it. Today's going to be a massive day of protest. ICE is doing what they do best. They've gotten rid of 3,000 illegal immigrants back to their home countries or in a facility en route to doing that in just the last 6 weeks, and 10,000 overall in Minneapolis alone. But not without controversy, not without paid protesters harassing them wherever they go in sub-zero weather. Congressman Jason Smith joins us now. Well, they were threatening to stop your appropriations bills from passing, Congressman or Chairman Smith, but they didn't. Enough Democrats voted with you, and you're passing the appropriations bills down to the Senate. Could you guys get things done in regular order? Is that what we're looking at?
This is actually the first time we have done this in a very long time, which is a big win for America. Whenever you do regular order, that's when you have true debate and discussion on the appropriations process. And I am so thankful that Republicans and Democrats learned from a 43-day government shutdown and decided to come together. And, you know, the appropriations bills that we passed are less than what Biden appropriations bills were. So those having a continuing resolution now will be under Trump appropriations, not Biden levels.
But you don't need a CR if you pass everything on regular order. Am I wrong?
That's exactly right. It's just in future. If there's a future CR, it would be tied to the new appropriations. What we did, we passed every one of the 12 appropriations bills out of the House, over in the Senate. Six of the 12 have already become law. We're working on the last six, and the Senate will get that done next week.
Yeah, let's hope so. So first off, looking at the economy right now, we have a growth over 4% again for two quarters in a row. Crime is making the quality of life better, and it looks as though employment is holding steady, which is still in and around 4 or 5%. Why don't more people say, according to surveys, that they feel that?
You know, first off, the GDP,
unbelievable,
even in the last week was reevaluated and scored up from 4.3 to 4.4%. And then this quarter, the most recent quarter, the fourth quarter, it's projected to be over 5%. And this is because of the tax certainty that was done in the One Big Beautiful Bill. And this is because of the certainty of the administration and all the investment that's coming back to the United States, which is a great thing. I think in the second and third quarter of this year, you're going to see really good GDP numbers, especially after people file their taxes. They experience the largest refund season in the history of America because of the tax provisions like no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, tax relief for seniors, the increased child tax credit, the increased standard deduction. You can go on and on of all the things in there that's going to help working families and small business owners.
Yeah, I mean, we're about to see it. So yesterday you brought the CEOs of healthcare companies to Capitol Hill. Between everything going on with what we saw in the scrutiny we were seeing on Capitol Hill, the Greenland, Davos, it didn't get as much publicity as it should have gotten. But I want to hear, this is you asking the CEOs something very specific. Cut 41.
Will you commit to supporting legislation that supports the president's calls to truly bring transparency to health insurance, will crack down on fraudulent enrollments, and holds insurers accountable for their excessive prior authorization and care denials? Mr. Hemsley.
We applaud the president's interest in this and focus. The ideas put forward could be part of meaningful change and solutions. We are aligned with the themes of those on transparency, accountability, addressing costs, and improving the system. So we'd be supportive of that as part of a broad-based, bipartisan solution to move forward in healthcare.
So, I mean, you had the CEO of the CEO of Elevate Health, the CVS CVS and the CEO of Ascendium all there in front of you. So do you think besides words, do you have any pledges? Did you learn anything from hearing their perspective on this?
You know, Brian, first off, sunlight is clearly the best disinfectant. Affordability starts with transparency and accountability, and that is why we brought in and requested the five largest health insurers. And actually, what we learned from the hearing is that they're not health insurers. They're actually healthcare empires because these entities just don't provide insurance. They provide medical services. They own doctors' clinics. They own PBMs. They own pharmacists. Even one of them owns a bank, Brian. This is so much more. So it's so unfair to the premium owner, the patient, because we saw these entities clearly put profits over patients just because of the effects that they've been doing. But they agreed to work together to figure out ways to drive down the cost of healthcare. And we're going to continue to work with them, but we're going to be doing some legislation. I'm going to be calling in the largest hospitals as well, because the insurers brought up things about hospitals. And the healthcare system is so broken. It's just not insurers. It's not just hospitals. It's not just drug manufacturers. It's a variety of problems. And no one's been able to take the battle on. We're doing it.
So listen to Frank Pallone, this Democrat who blames you guys for the high price of health care. Cut 38.
I appreciate the opportunity to hear from the executives of our nation's largest health insurance companies today. This is not your fault. This is the Republicans' fault. It's not your fault. Don't let them drag you in here and blame you for what's going on. It's not your fault.
How could it not be there? How could they not be their fault? They're getting the subsidies. Deductibles are going up and things are less affordable.
It's absolutely crazy that during our hearing, we saw Democrats actually defend the large health insurers. There was a question that was asked of the health insurers if they lobbied for the creation of Obamacare. And there were several that raised their hand saying that, yes, that they did. You know, and in the last 15 years since Obamacare was created, by Democrats, not by Republicans. That's the current healthcare structure that we're under. You have seen premiums rise 80%, more than 80%. But guess what? The profits of these healthcare empires, their stock prices have gone up on average 1,000% in that same time frame. Let me tell you, it doesn't smell well, and we're looking at all of it.
Yeah, now they're on the record saying they're going to help. Lastly, only 51% of the country says that Donald Trump's policies have made life less affordable for them. Besides the refunds, is there something else that could pass legislatively that would help sell your cause?
You know, we've been doing all kinds of things. The largest tax refund season that we're about to experience is going to be very helpful. But there's always more that we can do, Brian. The president came out with his great American healthcare bill. There's a lot of things in there that can help drive down the cost of healthcare. What the president's been doing in regards to drug prices is going to benefit so many Americans. And it allows Americans to be more competitive than other nations. So we got to continue to work. Housing is another issue that we're looking into. It's scary to think that first-time home buyers, the average age when President Trump was last in office was 32 years old. Today it is 40. That's the average age of a first-time home buyer.
Yeah.
People's priced out of it. Interest rates have been ridiculous. So there's a lot of things we can continue to work on.
Yeah, and of course, the executive order getting BlackRock and all these other companies out of buying single-family homes is going to help a lot. Congressman, Chairman Jason Smith, thanks so much.
Good to be with you, Brian.
Congratulations on passing those bills. It's up to the Senate to do their job. Back in a moment with Darrell Johnson. We talk a little football.
The headlines, the stories behind them, and the people who make them. Only on the Brian Kilmeade Show. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
I know the challenges. I understand the expectations. I know the fans are hungry for a winner. We're here with one mission: to become, to earn the right to be called the world champions in New York.
And that was John Harbaugh. And John Harbaugh got hired by the New York Giants. It's one of the most attractive coaches out there that was a free agent. And why? Because he got fired from the Ravens after 18 years and the 14th most successful coach in history. And he goes to the Giants at the age of 63. And he says they got to go to the playoffs. And, of course, that's always the goal. But he's always done it. Almost every year that he's coached, and there's a lot of optimism there. He thinks there's a lot of talent. There's a lot of coaching positions open now. A lot of people were shocked that the Bills' coaching positions open. The Ravens, obviously, is just got filled with the San Diego Chargers offense defensive coordinator, and we'll see how the rest of the positions go. So do the Falcons make their hire. But the big story is the teams that are left. Seattle against the Rams, the right to represent the NFC in the Super Bowl, and Denver against the Patriots. Helping us out right now to break it all down is Darryl Johnston, to win the Super Bowl three times with the Cowboys, a fantastic analyst now with Fox Sports. Darryl, welcome back.
How you doing, Brian? Good morning.
Hey, first, just for me, the main story is John Harbaugh getting hired. Your thoughts about, you maybe have caught some of the presser when his parents were there, how happy he seems to be. I think he had one day with not being a job and he realized he had a bunch of suitors. You've dealt with Harbaugh so often. What's he like? What's he like as a coach? Why is he effective?
He's great. I think he was really kind of the trendsetter when you looked at where people were looking for head coaches, because he has a special teams background, and the special teams coach is one of the coaches on your staff that will have the opportunity to address the entire team. And you always hear about how good is he in front of the room when you're looking at head coaching candidates. And, you know, when you're an offensive coordinator or a defensive coordinator, you have half the team. But as a special teams coach, you get to have everybody in there for the special teams meeting. So I think that that was one of the things years ago when John Harbaugh got into head coaching, that was one of the things that really kind of set him apart. He's been fantastic in Baltimore. When he was fired, it was going to be a mad dash to see who was going to get John Harbaugh as their next head coach. And I'm really, really happy that the Giants did that. I think it shows an aggressiveness within the organization to be able to follow the things that John talked about at his press conference. You know, we want to be able to earn the opportunity to play for a championship. He's going to give him that chance. And I wonder, to see Mike Tomlin step away after 19 years, John Harbaugh to be fired in Baltimore after 19 years, is there kind of a shelf life and you have to make that change? Because I know Steve Bisciotti, the owner in Baltimore, was very tight with John Harbaugh, and it's really a missed field goal at the end of the season. I mean, what do they do if that field goal is made and Baltimore ends up winning the AFC North and going into the playoffs and maybe they get on a run? Do you still make that same decision? And I think the same thing in Buffalo. You mentioned Sean McDermott a little bit there. At the top, I think the same thing with Sean McDermott. He's 12 victories away from Marv Levy. You know, who's out there for the Buffalo Bills to bring in? I thought Sean McDermott was not only a great head coach for the Bills, but he was fantastic in that community in Western New York. And being somebody who was born and raised in Western New York, I know how important that fan base is and that community is, and how much they want to win a championship. And I wonder where Buffalo is going to go to try and follow up what Sean McDermott had built.
Yeah, here's Terry Pegula, the owner, on what led him to the firing. Cut 46.
I saw the pain in Josh's face at his presser, and I felt his pain. I know we can do better, and I know we will get better.
So he saw, and he said that he walked over, didn't acknowledge him. When he walked over to him in the locker room, he was crying. But the main reason Josh Allen was crying, reportedly, was because he felt he played poorly. Now he needs surgery, maybe it has something to do with it. So he says he looked at him, and that's why he fired. I thought that was an odd thing to say, Darryl.
I think it just shows you the knee-jerk reaction for the decision he made to fire Sean McDermott. I have been in a locker room after the NFC Championship game where our championship teams in the 90s, it was the worst game we had ever played. We were down 21 points about 6 minutes into the game against San Francisco. I've been in that losing locker room after a championship game, and that is no time to make a decision. And Josh Allen, to your point, Brian, was emotional because of how he played during the game. And he felt he had let his team down. Now, you can get into all this nonsense about, you know, we didn't have wide receivers and we didn't have this and we didn't have that. But if you look at the body of work of Sean McDermott, I do not think it deserved a firing based on a crucial call.
Yep.
On that catch, no catch, interception in overtime. Your quarterback tried to do a little bit too much at times and put the team in a bad position. This was the year for the Bills to punch their ticket, because there is no Patrick Mahomes and there is no Joe Burrow and there is no Lamar Jackson. There is really no front runner in the AFC, you know, for the Super Bowl opportunity. And this was the year for the Bills to step through there. And Josh has got to be devastated, because he's the guy that was going to lead them there. And now he's probably the main reason why they didn't make it.
I just want you to hear that controversial play when it looked like a fantastic catch turned into a fantastic interception for the Broncos. Cut 44 in overtime.
Coming after him all out.
They pick it up and they go deep down the field. And the pass is caught. No, it's McMillan has the football. How about that? Jaquan McMillan.
Does he have a case? That's the question, Gene.
No, I don't think he does, Jim. I just don't think.
So they end up not canceling. I've got to get you on Denver and the Patriots. Who do you expect to win? Jared Steedham is going to be playing first start in a couple of years. What do you think?
Yeah, it's tough. It's going to be really hard for the Broncos. The Patriots, kind of that great story this year under Mike Vrabel in his first year. I love Bo Nix. We've had Denver a couple of times. I'm so disappointed that he's going to have the opportunity to lead his team to a Super Bowl. It's going to be hard. But the great thing about it is Vance Joseph and that right. defense are phenomenal. You get to look at the guys inside. We hear a lot about the edge rushers, but they're great inside. Darren Rizzi is a great special teams coach. Sean Payton will find a way to make it competitive.
Seattle Rams, real quick.
I'm going to go with Seattle. I know it's. I'm an offensive guy, and it's number one offense.
Daryl Johnson. Thanks so much.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. 1-866-408. 7669. Special thanks to Daryl Johnson. We're up against a hard break, but it was really nice to get his insight. As it always is great to bring in Trey Gowdy. You know, his show is every Sunday night. It's a wildly successful show. He's a host of Sunday Night in America with Trey Gowdy. He wanted to put Sunday Night in the title because he was always forgetting what day he was working. It is 9 o'clock. He's the author of The Color of Death. It's a great novel. He's a former chairman of the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. Trey, welcome back.
I've had a hard time keeping a job, Brian. When you introduced me, I can't keep a job.
I just want to make sure. I think it's so smart because people know Trey Gowdy. When's your show on Sunday night? It's automatic with your name. I'll tell you what, I'm struck by so many things. First off, just from the congressman analyst perspective, I know you're a legal expert. But your thoughts about the freak out over Greenland, where we ended up, and the way our European allies turned on us. I'm reading quotes from Latvia's president. Even though we've worked this out, we're still not out of the woods yet with our relationship. Really, Latvia? Do you think that France is going to save you if Russia's coming in? Maybe you should go to some type of therapy. How dare you jeopardize our relationship because of what's going on in with Greenland? I'm just stunned by Serbia came out. Their feelings are still hurt that we wanted and are interested in reorganizing our relationship with Greenland. Are you surprised?
I'm a little bit surprised at the whole thing. I think, Brian, because friends typically air their grievances privately.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of wondering, like, President Trump is not the first president to have his eyes on Greenland. I mean, Greenland, actually, you know better than I do, played a pretty significant role in World War II. I'm a little bit surprised it played out on the public stage. Here's a good thing about hurt feelings. They do tend to heal quicker than broken bones and other things. I think, you know, this time 4 days ago, my wife was asking me, well, she actually said, you can't pass a physical, so there's no way you'll be called up for the war with Greenland. And now all that's in the rearview mirror, and I think we're kind of in the reconciliation stage. I mean, if you and I were in a small country, our pride would probably exceed our military. I mean, we see that with other countries. Their pride, their national pride kind of exceeds their capabilities. I think, you know, give them a week to get over this. Read your history books about what America has done for the world, and things will be okay.
So a couple of things come to mind. Number one is I see the German chancellor is going to go over to China. We see the Canadian leader sell his soul to China a couple of weeks ago, including bringing their electric cars in, which is going to destroy their car industry, obviously, and the way they make it, the way the IP they stole in order to mass produce this. It's going to destroy Europe, too, and their car industry if they continue to do this. So there's going to be a sense in Europe that they're actually saying that China is a more dependable partner. What do you say to that?
Go look at their track record. If you want your intellectual property stolen, go ahead. Strike as many deals with China as you want. If you want your manufacturing decimated, look at what happened to the U.S. when we granted them most favored nation status. I am worried. I mean, if we would go to Venezuela because it's in our hemisphere, I am worried about our relations with Canada because, I mean, you're closer to Canada than I am, but I always just viewed them, I mean, they're a Five Eyes ally. Brian, they're one of our closest intelligence allies. And now they're, I mean, the closest point to Canada to China is 5,000 miles. The closest point. So far west Canada to China, 5,000 miles. All you got to do is walk across an invisible boundary line with the U.S. I don't know why Carney is doing this.
I mean, he's a globalist by nature. I think it's on his resume. And he's a liberal. And he feels as though he is, I guess, getting some political traction over the fact that he's standing up for Canada. But in reality, they only spend about 1.4% of their military. They literally have one rusty submarine. They have no Navy almost at all. The people that do fight, according to our men and women, they're great. But they have no way of supporting themselves militarily. We are their defense. And now Europe is making statements to the nature of maybe we got to go somewhere else for a nuclear umbrella. Okay, good luck with that. You know, I think North Korea is open for applications right now.
China, Russia, North Korea, Iran. I think, like, if Brian Kilmeade were in charge of communications or if Brian Kilmeade were running our foreign policy, and my guess is Marco probably is having these behind-the-scenes quiet conversations, just saying, you know, President Trump just has a different communication and negotiating style. I mean, there have been days when I woke up and wondered if my own mother loved me. And then that afternoon, he's inviting you to play golf. He just, I don't want to say it's because of geography, because I've never lived in New York. Might be because of what he did for a living, real estate development. He has a different communication style, but at this point, everybody knows that.
I thought so.
I would think so. And if you just talk to him, I mean, I am not a huge fan of communicating via social media. I'd rather pick up the phone and have that. And it's amazing when he does have those conversations, things are mollified. They calm down. If I'm Carney, you will never have a less reliable ally than China. And if his intelligence folks aren't telling him that, then they're doing him a disservice.
Right. Maybe some of their past prisoners that were taken for no apparent reason and jailed for a couple of years, maybe they want to whisper in his ear. So let's talk about ICE, because what's happening in Minneapolis is a travesty and embarrassment. They just don't realize it. J.D. Vance went to quiet things down yesterday. And here's a little about he's just trying to make cooler heads prevail. Cut to.
What I do need them to do is empower their local officials to help our local or help our federal officials out in a way where this can be a little bit less chaotic and it can be a little bit more targeted. Like, if we're trying to find a sex offender, tell us where the guy lives. Simple things like that, simple changes in how they're approaching immigration enforcement would make this work a lot better. It would make Minneapolis's streets a lot safer, and it would make this whole thing a lot less traumatic for this community.
Well, today they have a national day of protests where kids stay out of school, where nobody goes to work. I think in New York, they're all going to wear black in honor of the anti-ICE agents that are clearly getting paid. So what is your projection, Trey, about where this is going, as we know there's three arrests for the break-in in that church last weekend?
Yeah, I like to employ a little bit of rationality here. a little bit of logic. The E in I stands for enforcement. And to the president's earlier point this week, he closed the border, which no one thought was possible. He is deporting people who are indefensible. There is no argument that they should be left in the country. So then you ask yourself, why are Republicans underwater on the immigration issue? If he has done things like close the border and deport people that we all think should not be here, why is that not resonating more? And the answer is there are either enforcement orders out there that we're not communicating to the public. This was not us. Congress did this, or a judge did this. I don't think anyone enjoys seeing pictures of five-year-olds used as bait. Like, literally no one likes that. I don't, you know, ICE is doing what Congress and judges have told them to do. It's either a messaging issue, or they are not prioritizing deportations the way you and I would prioritize them. When the president was flipping through those pictures the other day in his press conference, I didn't see a soul that made me wonder, God, I really wish that person could stay here. But if you look at other media outlets, you sit there and think, well, these are not the worst of the worst.
Yep.
So I tend to not blame cops who are doing what judges, I mean, ICE does not have any power except what Congress and judges have directed them to do. So if you want to protest, you help me with my history. You've written more history books than I've read. Democrats had the House, Senate, and the White House under Biden. Did they do anything to restrict ICE's jurisdiction or enforcement capability?
No, I know that, what's his name, Joe Biden pared down the number of ICE agents and disempowered them the best he could through executive orders.
But they did not change the law.
No.
And they could have. So the E in ICE is enforcement. They're not enforcing their ideas. They're enforcing Congress and judges' ideas. I'd like to see them make the news for, we should not be losing this issue in the court of public opinion.
Well,
with a closed border, to be underwater. The president, he also said something I thought was fascinating this week, and it's probably what you've been saying, and it's certainly what I've been saying, which is you got to get all the facts before you reach a verdict on what happened with that shooting. And the president, you probably heard him, said, look, I've looked at the video, and I can see it both ways. I thought that was a pretty dramatic statement. It also happens to be the right statement, but it's a pretty dramatic statement for him to say. I think more comments like that, invading a church, the feds should not have to enforce the FACE Act, which was for abortion clinics. They should not have to enforce that. Minnesota state law enforcement should be protecting churches.
Do you know the cops were outside that church, and they knew they walked in there, knew exactly what was going on, and they didn't go in, which is crazy to me. That's just it. I'm having a little problem with I know cops not helping cops within the law. You know, I think there's got to be some more stuff that they could be doing. I'm not on the ground in sub-zero weather. I also don't get paid to do that. Most everybody else is to protest at each other or work there. But not letting them in convenience stores, not letting them use bathrooms, harassing them wherever they go. I'm talking about ICE agents. And when cops can either show up and thin out a crowd that's getting too aggressive, that's what I'm used to. And I saw Los Angeles at least step in more than the Minneapolis cops are stepping in. So I don't know what's going on there. That bothers me a lot. But lastly, I do think that the administration has to get on the same page, because I talked to higher ups within the Trump team that say we're getting aggressive, that people we're targeting are not the worst of the worst, and that's what we should be doing. Now, the five-year-old story, and you've probably heard that too, and the president said, if people have been here 20 years, I'm not looking to toss them out. Don't give them citizenship, but there might be a long-term work visa, Trey, that they get if they get a sponsorship. There's things that can be worked out right now.
Which is why, if you would just do what the president said, close the border, check, start getting rid of the worst, and start enforcing orders. Like, some of these people that are being removed, they were given a court date, they absconded, they failed to show up. Okay, that's not being a good citizen. That's not doing what you have not assimilated into our country. That's his other concern, is the lack of assimilation or lack of an interest in assimilating.
Yeah.
I think President Trump is I don't want to say moderate because that's a bad word apparently now, but he is more moderate on deportations than the public perception is right now. And I'm sure he's frustrated. Look, he did the impossible, Brian.
I know.
And he's not getting any credit for it.
How about the fact that crime's at a 100-year low, basically? A 100-year low. You're going to tell me that's because mayors and governors finally got tough in the New York, in the cities? There's no way. It's a lot to do with what you just mentioned. I mean, if you want a quality of life issue, that's a quality of life issue.
I do not understand why crime and foreign affairs do not impact elections more than they do, because there's not a right that you have that matters if you are living in fear or dead. I just don't understand why crime does not move the needle more come election time.
So, Trey, who's going to be on your show this weekend?
I've got former ambassador to Denmark. We're going to talk about ICE. I'm going to do it with a prosecutor and an ICE agent. We are going to talk about Davos, which you probably went to because you're rich and famous. I did not. I'm curious about this cap on credit card interest rates. I'm curious about, you know, not letting hedge funds buy houses. We're going to talk affordability. And then my favorite thing, Brian, I mean, you have the most impactful monologue on all of television. I tried to prep that monologue by answering viewer questions, which I love. Because most of the questions I get in life are from my wife, and it starts with, you are not playing golf again today, are you? I like open-ended questions, and I get some at the end of my show.
No, I know. It's great. I love it. It goes right into mine. So I'm watching it every single week. So
the most impactful monologue in television.
Yeah, I'd said in America. So
okay.
I don't know if you want to change
the world.
Yeah.
I think you're limiting yourself. By the way, when you came on my holiday special, I've had more people comment on that segment.
Wow.
So what guest should I have on Sunday night? Brian Kilmeade.
Absolutely. I love it.
They were blown away by that.
And you're the big success story on Sundays. You have been. And we're going to have to live through our last week of NFL football. This week, it's going to be tough. We got a 6:30 start. And that's why we got to counter program. Don't bring up sports, Trey. As far as we can, let's not bring it up.
I think our boss, well, I know they love you because you work every day, but I must have offended them to go up against NFL football.
It's almost over. Almost. We have a 6:30 start that's going to do damage. And then all of a sudden I'm thinking, okay, only Trey gets hurt. And then I'm watching overtime. And I'm going, oh, my goodness, now Kilmeade gets hurt.
The overtime, boy, I looked at my wife and said, the dozen viewers I normally have, I don't have this week. They're gone.
And including her. She's watching the game.
Yeah, she said, I don't know what you're talking about. Don't interrupt the game.
Yeah. So, Trey, I can't wait to watch. Great lineup as usual. Sunday at 9 p.m. Eastern time. Listen, it's going to be snowing. You're going to be snowed in more than likely. So you might as well be watching us. Appreciate it.
You got to get down south, Brian. You've got to come down south. You cannot survive a foot of snow.
I hear you. Now, you and Will are the only ones who worked that deal out. I got to figure that out for me. Go get him, Trey Gowdy. Thanks so much. Back in a moment to wrap up the hour. Don't move.
From breaking news to big name guests, Brian brings you insight you won't hear anywhere else. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
This weekend, there's a historic winter storm hitting most of the country that's bringing brutal temperatures and over 20 inches of snow. Ooh. Greenland heard and was like, well, you wanted us. You got us. Yeah, today, Southwest Airlines canceled hundreds of flights, although that had nothing to do with the storm.
I mean, how many flights have been canceled? That was pretty funny, though, right?
It was a good one.
How about this? On a serious note, but kind of like a furthermore, CBS is so interesting. What Barry Weiss is doing with the Free Press, her background is not necessarily the CEO of a TV company or a news company. She's an editorial writer, New York Times. Unbelievable success with Free Press. But it looks like some of the big wig reporters at 60 Minutes are pushing back and think they're going to win the power struggle. The Sharon Alfonsi and Scott Pelley, they now say their jobs are on the line, but they think they can outwait, or they think that, well, we got a new leader every 2 years. My take is when Oracle hired her and bought the Free Press, they're not going to get rid of Barry Weiss for Scott Pelley. Scott Pelley doesn't make or break the 60 Minutes. He failed as a nighttime anchor to attract an audience. They demoted him. And what about Cheryl Alfonso, who makes up stories about DeSantis? She's got a lot of problems with her reporting.
No, I know, and I love how they're like, oh, Barry is the enemy. Meanwhile, she's reporting to her bosses and doing what they want.
Yeah, she's trying to make it more balanced. She's never going to be left. I mean, if you watch CBS, it's still a little left, right? She's trying to bring a balance to it. And these people think they're bigger than the company. Crazy.
News headquarters in New York City. Always seeking solutions, never sowing division. It's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. So glad you're there. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show coming your direction. We've got a big hour coming your way. It was one of the final hours of the week, which has been a really busy week. You know, last year when the president won his election, he went to Davos, but he didn't actually go. He just satellited in and talked about what he wanted to do. And it was kind of interesting because, you know, you got a brand new president, brand new focus, very entrepreneurial, business oriented. Well, this year he dominated. It might as well have been a G7, G20. It went from an entrepreneurial business conference to where people talk about their economies and innovation to all about Donald Trump and Greenland. Not many people anticipated that. Alex Gray will go inside the Trump team and what they plan on doing to make the president more domestically oriented over the next 11 months. That seems to be what the constituents want. Alex Gray was the former CEO of American Global. He is the CEO of American Global Strategies. He served as deputy assistant to president's chief of staff last term. And Shannon Bream is standing by. So we're following that as well as the actual day of protest when it comes to ICE in Minneapolis. Like, we haven't had enough. Let's get to the big three.
Number three.
Do you think we are close to the final 10% of this deal? Do you think this can get done in the next few weeks?
The final 10%, I don't know about the next few weeks, but I know we've made more progress, according to the Ukrainians, more progress than in the last 3 or 4 years.
Well, I think that's pretty important, and that's what Steve Witkoff says. Trouble spots front and center. Ukraine and Iran, how both will be confronted, and I think have some type of resolve within 2 weeks.
Number two.
Do a lot of campaign traveling. Now, we're going to work hard. Whatever reason, it's a deep down psychological reason. Sitting presidents don't seem to do well in the midterms.
That's in the past, but the president's want to make history now. 11 months of the midterms, the president will have a laser focus on the economy. First stop, Iowa.
Number one.
There's some hope, some reason to think that there's going to be better cooperation in the weeks and months to come. These people are going to step up and actually ask the cops to protect our ICE officers when they're being assaulted.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it? ICE not getting anywhere as the VP headed to Minneapolis to bring down the temperature. Would that work? Let's bring in Shannon Bream to discuss it. Shannon, the vice president wanted to call out the rhetoric, but also bring down the tempers and temperature. I'm not sure that's going to work in a national day of protest in Minneapolis. What do you think?
I got to give it to these protesters. I mean, they're a hearty bunch up there in Minneapolis because it's terrible weather. These conditions are so tension filled. And I hate for our law enforcement officers that they're put in this position. But I thought the vice president shared a lot of important information that was actually helpful. Because you have to be able to have a narrative that's factual. And a lot of this has not been. And what that ends up doing is making people feel like they're good people. They're justified in going after ICE because it's doing something illegal or unethical. And that just creates a dangerous situation for these officers.
Yeah, but I mean, this is by far the worst. You know, D.C., mm-hmm. they brought down crime 40%.
Oh, yeah.
Denver 40%. Los Angeles down 34%. So you really see the impact. Louisiana, overwhelming success. Same with Memphis. And in Minneapolis, it's been nonstop fighting since the shooting. And there was another shooting. But now we have a mayor and governor who have no interest in seemingly to end this. They want to, in my view, overwhelm the fraud investigation.
Yeah, and it's taking a lot of headlines away from that. Now, you'll notice that there are members of the administration saying, including the president, don't worry. We've still got our eye on that. And there's a lot that's going on Capitol Hill as well, too, you know, with various investigations which may fan out from Congress as well. So the headlines, though, the protesters know this. The lawmakers there know this. They're now facing their own DOJ subpoenas about, you know, what they've said or telegraphed about these ICE operations there. But the fact is, there seems to be a unique problem problem in Minneapolis. And, you know, the other side of this argument across from the government will argue it's because there's such a huge show of force. I mean, 3,000 ICE agents were supporting law enforcement. You know, but the other side will say, listen, you guys let yourself be a sanctuary city, a sanctuary state. So you've got tons of people here that happen to be on our list of the, quote, worst of the worst. These are not people who just came here illegally, although, listen, ICE has every right to get them and pick them up as well by law. If you don't like it, change the law. But these are some people that are child rapists, predators, murderers. I mean, that's not disputed information.
Here's the mayor. Cut one.
What Vice President J.D. Vance is saying is he's rhetorically asking what makes Minneapolis different. What makes Minneapolis different is that we have an influx of 3,000 federal agents on our street, and we're not the size of New York City or Los Angeles. What makes us different is we're seeing constitutional violations play out in real time. What makes us different is, yes, we do have residents that are beautifully standing up, supporting their neighbors, providing food, escorting them to their jobs, recording some of the unconstitutional acts that are taking place to make sure that some sunlight is added as a disinfectant to some of the chaos.
I can't even listen to him anymore. He's so full of it. He's created this angst. These are not peaceful protests. And not only that, they're locking them out of convenience stores, making them, refusing to let them use bathrooms, harassing them at hotels, banging pots, getting in the way of their apprehensions. Just despicable behavior, all paid and all cheered on by a guy that really thinks this is about love. He actually said that this is about love.
Well, that's a very difficult definition to wrap around what we're watching and seeing. I mean, right now on Fox, if people have, you know, our air up on the TV side of things, they're seeing what we're talking about. And these are very dangerous situations. Again, the people on one side feel justified because they've been told these people are Nazis. They're the Gestapo. They're kidnapping and disappearing American citizens. I mean, they've been told all kinds of inaccurate information that makes them feel justified. So in a way, you know, you got to think the people who fed them that information and allowed them to believe that what they're doing is righteous, they bear responsibility because our officers still have to walk into these situations no matter what. And listen, they'll tell you, too. Of course, the administration will say they also have to abide by the law. You know, ICE agents, they've got protocols, they've got laws, but they're also being put in situations where they have to make split-second decisions like all of our law enforcement officers do. And that's a really difficult thing to put on them in the middle of these circumstances.
All right, so there's going to be, let's talk politics, because that's what's going to be the next 10 months will be about, I think, even though I think there's going to be military operations in Iran. Let's hope they can land the plane in Russia, but I just think Vladimir Putin is just dragging this out. Here's the president yesterday on Air Force One, cut 10.
I do a lot of campaign traveling, I hate to tell you guys, but to keep you employed. Now, we're going to work hard. But the only problem with that question is, for whatever reason, it's a deep down psychological reason, sitting presidents that won, even that won big, we won big, all seven swing states are popular vote, sitting presidents don't seem to do well in the midterms.
He knows it, but he also is going to be in Iowa. And I also think his growth at 4.4% GDP, back-to-back 4-plus GDP numbers, and about to get some massive refunds from the big, beautiful bill. And you see crime down. That's a quality of life issue. There's a lot of things, I think, pointing in his direction. Let's see if the American people will be open to it.
Yeah, and you and I can, we know this. I mean, you talk about polls or stats. What matters to people is what they feel when they go to the grocery, when they fill up their gas tank, which that's been an improvement for them. So you can say good things are coming and point to GDP. Most people on their average every day, they're not tracking GDP. You know, they need to know what it feels like in their real life. So if some of that translates, as you said, if they get nice tax refunds, those kinds of things will be real world impact for people. So the administration's really placing a lot on these hopeful things that still have to play out, because the polling shows us now, New York Times, Siena has new polling out that's not good for the president on a number of these big issues. So they need something to materialize in a very concrete way for people's wallets in the next 6 months or so.
Yeah, if it's possible, because I think in many ways, I think, you know, if you're a president that's popular, you used to get maybe 63% approval. Obama early on, for example. I think the best any Democrat or Republican can do is maybe 53%, 52%. Right. So the president's at roughly 44. The last poll said 40. And they, on the economy, 51% disapprove, said things have gotten worse for them. I don't know how, but maybe the people just dug in. I want you to hear some crazy things that Stacey Abrams says. Cut 14.
Okay. Economic populism raised up Hitler in Germany. It raised up Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, and we watched it raise up Trump and his regime right here in America. But when the people have been sold a lie, they lose faith. And when the liars gain and hold power, the people lose the right to be heard unless we fight for democracy, unless we connect it back to what we need.
Right. Now you know why she lost twice as governor. And Stacey Abrams. Yeah, I believe so. I know she didn't admit to the first. She puts Trump with Hitler and Hugo Chavez. That's interesting. And lie. What do you lie about? Sealing the border? What do you lie about? Growing the economy? What do you lie about? And the unemployment's basically the same as Joe Biden has. He has lower interest rate. And little by little, the prices are coming down. Not quick enough for the average American, but they are coming down.
They are. They're moving in the right direction. But again, when you call people Hitler, when you call them Nazis, you create in some, you know, wackadoodles minds that are not functioning properly, that it's okay to take out that threat. I mean, this is a president that had two assassination attempts. I mean, was within millimeters of losing his life a couple of years ago. So I really think when people do this, you want to demonize your opponent politically. I mean, both sides have done that. But what we're talking about right now is calling ICE agents, the president, Republicans, repeatedly things that make them be viewed as a threat that may be right in some people's minds. It justifies going after them. So
absolutely.
You know, the border, by the way, the border is the one thing where the president is above water in this new New York Times Siena polling. It shows that people think he's done a great job. Well, yeah, when you have like zero people coming across, and it used to be like 10, 15,000 people a day, you got to give him credit for that. So that is actually breaking through across party lines.
And over 2 million have self-deported in this country. 600,000 have been tossed out. So I think there's some interesting numbers. I think that has a lot to do with the diminishing crime. I always say to myself, when I can't figure something out, it's a hard issue, I wonder how the views handle it. They always are speaking so clearly and concisely and so in an enlightened way. Here's Whoopi Goldberg on what's wrong with the president. Cut 16.
25th Amendment.
Right. It's time.
25th Amendment. It's time. It's time.
You would be in a lot of company. You believe at this point that the president of the United States may not have his full faculties.
I felt that before now.
Yeah, but the cherry on the cake was yesterday.
Well, no, there's been a lot of cherries on the cake. There have been several. The cherries on this cake are enormous.
Yeah.
There are
it's
so
a
many.
Tree.
There are the lines in the sand. Yeah. I mean, it looks like a stamp. There's so many lines in the sand.
The only thing in that Siena poll that was strong was that the American people, 63%, do not think age is a factor with him. Mm-hmm. So nice try. The people that told you Joe Biden was great are now deciding that Trump is shot.
We would go days without hearing from President Biden. And when he would show up, he would have notes and pictures telling him who the reporters are, who to call on, his talking points on how to answer each question. This president, whether you like him or not, that's not going to be the same comparison. This is a guy who goes on 4 or 5 hours of sleep at night. If that, I have cabinet secretaries telling me he calls them at 2 a.m. like, hey, are you up? And they're like, well, I am now. I mean, the president calling. And then he goes and does, you know, press conferences for an hour or two, holding forth on any number of different foreign and domestic issues. I mean, the comparison is just so stark. I think most members of the media, I mean, the media and people who cover the president, will tell you it is such night and day between covering these two different administrations. And you don't have to like President Trump. But, man, if you weren't calling for the 25th Amendment during the last administration, you know, you might want to think twice about it with
and,
this one.
And lastly, just on Russia, we know we sent Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner and another envoy from the new Board of Peace over to Russia. And they now have two envoys going to Abu Dhabi, including the lawyer that was working out of Miami. And one of the statements that came out was Vladimir Putin is sincere in this effort. Not that he hasn't been sincere to date. He started the whole thing. And of course, Ukraine has landed the plane in terms of what they need to end this. Do you think anything will be different, or are you like me and you think this is a delay of game?
I always feel like Putin's about delay of game. It's really difficult because what we know of the contours of these deals, we'll ask Ukraine to give up sovereign territory that Russia came and wrongfully took from them. They don't want to leave that taste in Putin's mouth, you know, because he can say like, okay, but this is it, not anymore. But who's to say? I mean, if he has another incursion across those lines, how is Ukraine to be certain that short of starting World War III, they're going to have a good deal? I think Putin is constantly pressing for more time. You know, you've got the sanctions bill sitting there in the Senate that would not only go after Russia, but everyone trading with Russia. And, you know, when other countries start to feel the pain, that might tighten the vise on them a little bit. But Putin doesn't seem very motivated, to my mind.
Shannon, who's going to be on Sunday?
Well, we're going to have Senator Jean Shaheen. She is the foreign relations ranking member. She was just over in Denmark trying to settle this whole Greenland thing. So we're going to see if she knows any more about the deal than we do. We'll talk Russia-Ukraine. We'll talk Iran. We'll talk all of this. And also these reports that the administration is looking for regime change in Cuba before the end of this year. Plus, the senators have to find a way in the middle of this storm to get back to Washington. There's no long-distance proxy voting for them. Or else we run out of government funding a week from today, next Friday. So how do they plan to do that?
Are they going to stick around Monday, Tuesday, or are they leaving like the House is?
They're not here. You know, the Senate's out right now, so they have to get back here. And that is not going to be an easy lift from across the country.
Yeah, the House is back. They can leave.
The House has done their stuff. They're leaving. And so it's, you know, the ball is in the Senate's court, but it really gets down to Friday. And now you have folks like Senator Tim Kaine out there saying, hey, I'm not voting on this thing without amendments. And there are enough Democrats that you could hold this thing up. But if they amended it, it would have to go back to the House again and then back to the Senate and then to the president. All of that happening by Friday in the middle of Snowmageddon.
Crazy.
You know, it's a tricky balance. What about you on Sunday night?
Sunday night, we got the Ruthless podcast. All of them are going to be there. That'll be good. Senator Cornyn's going to be with us. We know that for sure. Steve Mosher, a Chinese expert, is going to be there. Carly Shimkus is going to be with us. So we're going to have a big show covering all things beginning in Davos, but not ending in Davos.
Okay, my question is, are you going to do this from the comfort of your couch, maybe on Zoom? Because, I mean, you know there's a big storm coming.
I know. You know what?
You have a backup plan?
That's why I got snowshoes for Christmas. That's what I need.
And you got those doggies. You got some strong, big, adorable doggies. And I feel like you could put together like your own sled situation.
They cannot wait to pull me to work. Thanks so much, Shannon Bream. I appreciate
it. Sunday night.
And you are, of course, watching Shannon on Zoom. Back in a moment.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
We're going to push like the Dickens now to make international more important with us. Every team will go to 18-2, you know, and eliminate one of the preseason games. And every team every year will play one game overseas. And part of the reason is so we can continue to grow the cap and keep our labor happy.
So you want to make more money, Bob Kraft is saying, got to go international and grow the game. And then add a week, get more revenue, and get rid of preseason. Preseason is the biggest joke. Biggest joke. I mean, I know you want to see some rookies. You get that out of a practice. Televise some practices. So now with football, I know labor's going to push back on that because it's such a brutal sport and you pay such a physical price. So I look forward to that. And listen, I cannot believe the Patriots are one win away against a team they normally would be underdog to. I don't think they will with Jason Steedham, with him as a quarterback. I think he was fine. I think he's solid. But he's not Bo Nix. And the guy breaks his ankle in the last game and they still won. And now that's the only thing really stopping Denver from getting through. And if they do get through, it really hurts the storyline just a little bit because then you have a team that gets through with a quarterback that is, you know, backup at best and who hasn't started a game in 2 years. That's interesting. And the other side, I think the Rams find a way to beat Seattle, as good as Seattle looked last week. All right, back to real sports, and that's life. Alex Gray joins us next. He is the former deputy assistant to the president and chief of staff of the White House National Security Council. He is now a CEO of the American Global Strategies. We're going to talk all things Trump in just a moment.
Mouth to your ears. It's Brian Kilmeade.
We had a good meeting today with President Zelensky. I think America, you know, what's happened here is there were times when Putin didn't want to make a deal, times when Zelensky didn't want to make a deal, and it was like opposite times. Now I think they both want to make a deal.
It's really not opposite times. I know the president's trying to spin it positively, but Zelensky wants to make a deal. He liked the fighting to start. He didn't start it. He's surviving through it. Now 60% of the country's in the dark and freezing, and because they can't get anywhere on the ground. They've lost 35,000 people last month. Do you believe that? 35,000 Russian soldiers dead, and they've gained just kilometers, and it's not much. So we see now all goes to Abu Dhabi. All the focus is, again, on America to do this. It's us that go and shuttle diplomacy back and forth. It's us that has to bring some type of semblance of peace and stop the war with Israel and the Palestinians and Hamas in Gaza. You know, everything basically comes back to us. And yet you have people all bent out of shape, threatening to go to China because they don't like our stance with Greenland, even though that seems to be that bullet seems to be dodged, and they're working on and talking about the deal that they cut. Alex Gray joins us now, CEO of American Global Strategies, served as deputy assistant to the president and chief of staff of the White House National Security Council. Alex, this almost one year in, how would you grade the president compared to his last year, his first year in his last term?
Well, I would give it, it's night and day, Brian. I mean, it's actually so much better. I can't even give it a grade. I mean, I was there the first day of the first term. And, you know, the biggest challenge we had people at the cabinet level who openly despised the president they worked for and were trying to undermine him left and right. They didn't agree with the things he was elected to do. And now we have a cabinet of competent, loyal people who are implementing his agenda every day. It's night and day.
Yeah, I mean, no doubt about it. And you had the whole Russia thing hovering over, saying that he won illegitimately. And that was turned out as it turned out. So when you see some of the numbers about the president right now, he's got 40% approval rating. 32% say their life is better than it was. 51% said their economy was better before he got there. The numbers belie it, the opportunities, the deals cut, the trade deals and things to that nature. But if you're next to the president and you're looking at those numbers, and you believe them, where do you go from there?
Well, look, I as a foreign policy guy, it pains me to say this, but you know, the American people don't vote on foreign policy, right? The American people vote on things that are going on at home. The purpose of the America First foreign policy agenda is to give us the strength overseas to allow the president and the Republican Party to focus on the people's immediate needs at home. I think the president's got a lot of cleanup to do after the Biden years, and I think he's well on his way to finishing that cleanup, but he's got to pivot now to the main issues that are motivating people in their daily lives at the dinner table. And that's where we need to be headed, is back to a domestic focused agenda once he's cleaned up the fires that are the Biden folks left.
That's true. It must be frustrating, though. If I told you I had back-to-back quarters at over 4% growth with the unemployment basically holding, interest rates going down, We're getting close to the point where people are probably going to start making some moves. If I gave you those numbers, you'd probably tell me, Brian, I'll tell you what, the president's approval rating is going to be a lot higher than it is right now. What do you think disconnect? Do you think a lot of it is we are just so polarized, either side will never give that other president credit?
Look, there's some of that, but we also have something that I think is really interesting starting to happen, where economic growth numbers are not necessarily being reflected in the average American's take-home pay and their sense of their own economic success. And you're beginning to see this kind of dual track economic recovery, where people are disconnected from these numbers that the Bureau of Economic Statistics put out, because they're still feeling price increases. Their average wages are not rising fast enough to keep up with prices. I mean, so there's a disconnect in the economics here. And again, you know, not to put everything on the previous administration, but it's only been a year. There's a lot of climbing out of the most disastrous economic policies since the Carter years that still has to be done.
Yeah, no doubt about it. So let's see if that's going to happen. First off, I know you're a foreign policy guy, but a 10% cap on credit cards seems like a good way to stop the gouging. But on the other hand, the CEO and banks say, well, that means a lot more people are not going to be eligible for credit cards if the interest rate is going to be at 10%. So that, as opposed to 26%, do you think that might be detrimental to making people feel better about their situation?
Look, I don't worry about it too much, Brian. I mean, I think that one of the things that, when you think about what is the issue that's most negatively affecting people and what are they saying in surveys, what are they saying to their friends and neighbors? They're saying, they get in the cycle of endemic debt. They get in the cycle of usurious interest rates that are just bleeding them dry. And, I think the president has to think about this not necessarily from, what is the ideal Milton Friedman approach to free market, free market economic approach. I think in a perfect world, we'd love to do whatever our libertarian economics textbooks told us to do. I think he's got to look at this from the perspective of the average American who is dealing with these usurious interest rates. And that's what he's doing. And I think it's going to have a positive overall economic benefit by giving people more disposable income to spend in the economy when they're not racking up these astronomical credit card debts.
I love the fact that Blackstone is and companies like that are going to be prevented from buying any more single family homes because what was going on was absolutely insane. Mr. and Mrs. Johnson are bidding against these behemoth investment companies and then we'll become a country of renters. So the president put a stop to it. Hopefully he can put together something legislatively that would implement that effectively. So let's go to an area of expertise. Steve Witkoff, after meeting to Bloomberg TV, after meeting with Vladimir Putin along with Jared Kushner, Cut 27.
Do you think we are close to the final 10% of this deal? Do you think this can get done in the next few weeks?
The final 10%, I don't know about the next few weeks, but I know we've made more progress in the last 6 or 7 weeks since Geneva than we've made, according to the Ukrainians now. I'm going to use their what they say. According to the Ukrainians, more progress than in the last 3 or 4 years.
So he's trying to be optimistic. What do you think, Alex?
Look, I think that the United States has a unique opportunity here because the way the Russians, despite the daily news that the Russians are on the ascendancy, Russia is in terminal decline. This military adventure has shown them to be completely headed to the ash heap of history. And I think we have an opportunity to put pressure on them, military, intelligence and other pressure, economic pressure, continue what the president has been doing, seizing the sanctioned oil all over the world. We can force Putin to the table with his tail between his legs if we keep putting more pressure on him. Despite some of the media speculation, notice, Brian, the president has never taken our intelligence sharing away from Ukraine. The president has never taken away some of the targeting that we do and coordination we do behind the scenes with the Ukrainians. We can increase that. We can do more there. I think Putin needs to come to the table completely convinced that he has no tactical path forward. And that's when we will get the deal that we need to have a lasting peace.
So you got to up the ante, up the flow, get them the Patriot missiles that they've been asking for and the support. And I would say the Tomahawks. I mean, that might force them from the table permanently. I'm not sure. But just to say, look, you can't just have one side being able to reach the other's capital, especially when that side started this whole thing.
Yeah. And look, the president has a blueprint for this. This is what we did in the first term when President Trump was the only American president since the end of the Cold War on whose watch Putin didn't do any territorial aggression. And that was because we consistently made it clear publicly and privately that we would not allow, we would deter, we would prevent, we would do any means necessary to prevent Putin from expanding territorially or engaging in aggression against his neighbors. And that's the path here. Overwhelming American strength. Donald Trump has two things going for him. He's got restored deterrence and he's got the strategic ambiguity that he cultivates where you never know what he's going to do. He likes to compare himself to Nixon and the madman theory. The fact that Putin doesn't know how far he's willing to escalate and the fact that he's restored the lost deterrence from the Biden era, that gives us the ability to put Putin on his heels and to drive a deal that is to our benefit and the benefit of a long-lasting peace.
I hear you. Now let's go to Iran if I can. The President of the United States yesterday on Air Force One, Cut 28.
We have a lot of ships going that direction just in case. We have a big flotilla going in that direction. And we'll see what happens. A big force. We have a big force going toward Iran. I'd rather not see anything happen, but we're watching them very closely.
And they're just killing their people by the thousands. And the president says we have a flotilla there led by the USS Abraham Lincoln. The USS George H.W. Bush is also evidently heading that direction. We did say we would support the protesters, many of which are dead. So what do you think? What is America? What should America do from here on in?
Yeah, well, Brian, we should ask what's our core interest here, right? And our core interest is making sure that the Ayatollahs do not have the ability to reconstitute their nuclear program and their missile program, threaten Israel, threaten our Gulf Arab allies, and they don't have the ability to reconstitute Hezbollah and Hamas and Islamic Jihad and all the other groups that they've been funding that have been spreading terror for 35 years. That's our core interest. And now we have to stand in solidarity with the Iranian people. We can't have an Obama 2009 moment. But I think first and foremost, we have to make clear to the Ayatollahs that this terror strike group is in the region to make clear America has some red lines, right? America, unlike Obama, these are red lines that are going to be stick and we're going to keep to them. Again, to me, it's nuclear program, missile program, and restarting the proxies. And if they go down the road of doing those again, the president reserves and should reserve every right to do another midnight hammer operation.
Alex Gray, we also have the White House has now announced agreements between Caracas and Washington on the sale of $500 million worth of Venezuelan crude. They said that they already have $300 million from us. And it looks like Rodriguez, as checkered as our past is moving forward on providing security for any other companies that want to come in and begin to drill oil in the in their country. I'm not sure what it's like on the streets. I don't get many reports. What are you hearing? And what about the progress since Maduro was taken?
Well, it's hard to deny that the progress in getting a compliant Venezuelan regime, because they don't want to have, you know, Delcy Rodriguez and her brother don't want to look up and see Delta Force coming through the chimney, right? They don't want to deal with that. They don't want to have sonic weapons hitting their Cuban guards. I think it's very clear that, you know, look, there needs to be a transition, Brian, to a democratic process. That's going to take time. And we have a precedent. Look at Spain after Franco. Look at the Indonesia after their dictatorship. We don't always, when we have successful democratic transitions, they don't always happen overnight as much as we'd like that. Sometimes we have to have a former member of the bad regime that stays in power for a little bit. I think that's what's happening here. And hopefully over the next year, 2 years, 3 years, we redo this institutional structure in Venezuela that has been destroyed over 25 years by the Chavistas. We have to rebuild it with them and be in a position that we can actually have a free and fair democratic election and get someone like a Machado in.
Yeah.
Who's going to be a long-term partner.
Alex, you think 2 years before an election?
At least.
Wow. Okay. Lastly, the president evidently says, I want a regime change in Cuba before the end of the year. It doesn't look, they got one people, you know, who's putting, giving them a lifesaver these days? Mexico. They're flowing oil into Cuba. We got to put a stop to that. And then who else is keeping that horrible regime in power? It's time for the Castros to go. Do you think the president's got, does the president need a plan for that? And what would it look like?
Well, I think the beginning of a plan is emerging, Brian, and it starts with, like you said, Mexico is part of the problem, but China has a surveillance station there right off the coast of Florida, 90 miles. The Russians have been still pumping as many resources as they can spare to help the Cubans stay in power, help the Castro regime stay in power. And the Venezuelan oil was a major, major part of keeping that regime afloat. Cut off the Venezuelan oil, make clear to Mexico that this is non-negotiable for us. This is a direct threat to the security of the United States. Make that clear to them that we will not tolerate that. And tell the Chinese, if you want to have a trade negotiation with us, you will remove your surveillance stations from the Cuban coast immediately as a prerequisite for any conversation with us on trade.
Greenland, do you like the deal as it's taking shape now, expanding bases, having command center led by an American commander in the area, begin to patrol the Arctic and possibly have a, I'm not sure about the details, but I know there's have something to do with the rare earth that they have. What do you think about how this deal is taking shape?
It's a great start. It solves a number of immediate term problems. I think over the long term, Brian, my biggest concern, as I've written about and testified about, is that Greenland's going to go back on its path to independence. An independent Greenland eventually is going to be quickly gobbled up by the Chinese and the Russians. And we have to have a longer term political solution that makes sure that we don't have a Chinese colony on our coast. That can look in a number of different ways. This solves the immediate term, and the president deserves a huge amount of credit for it. But this is going to be a problem that's going to outlast whoever's in the Oval Office right now.
I hear you. Thanks so much. Alex Gray, always great. CEO of the American Global Strategies. Go get him, Alex.
Thanks, Brian.
All right. Back in a moment. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Where big stories meet bigger conversations. Stay informed and energized with the Brian Kilmeade Show. A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
The President of the United States is crazy. And the consequences of that, you know, we've survived so far. But there's nothing that he says or does that makes any sense. And we're just sitting here, we're like the old guy, flea-bitten dog baying at the moon. We're not effective in this. The only people can be effective are the Republicans.
Okay, let's think about what he just said, James Carville. I don't know why we give him such airtime. Nothing he does make any sense. Nothing he does doesn't make any sense. You don't like the way he approached Greenland? That's the way you say it. But nothing he does make any sense. Flea-bitten dog. It doesn't even... But if everyone goes back to him and he's guaranteeing 40, 50 seats, just like he guaranteed Kamala Harris would win the election. Right. Good luck with that. I say he's a Charles Barkley politics because he's a great soundbite. No doubt about it. And he's direct. No doubt about it. And he's extreme. He's crisp. So people are like, oh, my God, that's fantastic. Or, you know, remember when that he had the oil leak in Texas and he was calling out Obama, we're dying over here. I remember that. So people like him as a guest, but he's not, I don't think he's in touch with people anymore. I mean, he doesn't never leaves his house, sits there with his rugby shirt, watching sports all day, waiting for CNN to call. So quick note, you're going to love the show One Nation on Sunday. Right after the game, I want you to watch, right after Trey Gowdy, I should say, I want you to watch. Got the Ruthless podcast coming up. Steve Mosher, you know how great he was on the radio show this week. He's going to unwind. Is China going to accept all our allies now? What's the downside of that? Tongue in cheek. I'll have Carly Shimkus is going to be with us, too, and a lot of other great guests like Larry Kudlow. The president's going to focus on the economy. I'm sure he's going to be calling Larry about it. He's going to first come down One Nation, Sunday at 10.